Our first case this morning is number 042992 and 3120, American National Bank and Trust Company of Chicago against Equitable Life Assurance Society of the United States. Counsel.
Good morning. May it please the court, Michelle Odorizzi for Appellant Equitable. I'm here today to ask the court to reverse an unprecedented sanctions order that required Equitable to produce more than 430 documents on which it had claimed privilege, even though the magistrate had reviewed only 44 of the documents in camera and had found that only 15 were not privileged in home.
Counsel, if I could ask you to raise your voice a bit. That records, but it does not
amplify
very well, and you're competing with this GSA fan over the judge's heads.
Thanks. Thank you, Your Honor. Now, as a result of that sanctions order, Equitable was required to produce a number of documents that are indisputably privileged, including an evaluation by its own in-house lawyer of the very claims that are being made in this action.
Do we have any idea how many of these documents involve communications by the in-house attorney?
Well, a great many of them do, Your Honor. The one document that I'm talking about that was produced is actually a memo that says you've asked for my legal advice, an analysis of the claims that Emerald could make, and it gives the in-house lawyers.
The reason I ask
assessment.
Is that that's a particularly difficult area of attorney-client privilege, and if we're going to be judging the good faith of your of client, we really ought to know a little bit about. Really ought to know a little bit about these documents, yeah, and what kind of privilege was asserted.
That's right, Your Honor. You're right that it is a particularly difficult area because it is sometimes difficult to tell, particularly if you're looking at isolated documents, whether the lawyer is copied because they're being asked for legal advice or whether they're copied because they're just being copied and there's business advice involved. Now, Equitable, obviously, is a large company. There were over 20, I believe, in-house lawyers who are listed on this log. And so it's not the kind of company where lawyers are consulted on business matter where they wear more than one hat. We believe that the very fact that you consult a lawyer in the context of a large corporation like this and you send a lawyer documents indicates that there is a privilege involved, that you are consulting them for legal advice. And if I can go to a couple of examples, since Your Honor asked, of these kinds of documents. One of the documents that the magistrate said was not privileged here is a report by a vice president who met with Emerald on the day that they told Emerald to stop their market timing activity. And it's a report that goes to the in-house lawyers and to other members of the control group at Equitable, telling them, here's what Emerald said, and saying, I think that they are probably going to assert that this is not consistent with the deal that they made. And this goes to the lawyers. Now, certainly, if at the end of it there had been a statement, legal department, please advise as to how we should proceed with Emerald, one would say that was a privileged document. The magistrate here said, oh, it's just a report of what's going on. It's not a request for legal advice.
I may shift the focus just slightly. While it may have been a very difficult area for your client to discern whether there was a privilege or privilege would be upheld, privilege would not be upheld, we do have the situation of repetitive problems here. I mean, this wasn't just one sampling and finding a certain number of documents that the magistrate judge did not think were privileged, but there were several tries, and you folks didn't make it to the judge's satisfaction each time. I mean, it's a persistence to the problem here that really does militate the other way, doesn't it?
Well, Your Honor, the first time the judge looked, there were 10 randomly selected documents, and the judge made his determinations of privilege, with which we didn't always agree. We thought those were good faith assertions of privilege. The second time, it was on a motion to compel, where Emerald went through and said, you know, there was a dispute about 30 documents. Some documents were then produced. We went back, and they finally moved to compel 16. We gave them two and said, you know, okay, we'll give you those two. And then there were 14 documents that the magistrate ruled on. And at that point, everyone thought the whole thing was over. The privilege log debate was over. Emerald had no more documents that it was going to ask for. In fact, on the record, they all say, well, good, that was a difficult situation. It was a hard thing to do. It's now done. And then 6 weeks later, Emerald comes in and says, Judge, you should sanction him. We're still not happy with the privilege log. So they thought they had been done. And at that point, the magistrate says, well, I'm going to go adopt this procedure. I'm going to look at 20 documents that I'm going to let Emerald pick. And then if I find four or more not privileged, I'm going to infer bad faith and you get sanctioned. Now, of course, the day he came out on the bench, the magistrate said, I found four that were not privileged. Equitable, you win, no bad faith. And then counsel for Emerald said, but Judge, that wasn't the procedure you said. And the magistrate actually had to go back into his chambers, look up the transcript, and see what he said. And then he changes on a dime and comes out and says, well, I think there's bad faith.
How many were on that last list? 40?
20.
20?
20.
Well, that was the random selection, though, wasn't it? Or
I no.
should say random. That, what, did they pick out the 20?
They picked the 20.
And then it turns out four of those were, in determination of the magistrate judge, not privileged.
Not privileged, right.
Well, let me ask it again. What did your Fifth Amendment log or whatever the last?
Fourth.
Fourth Amendment. How many were on that?
433, I think, is the number. Could be off by one or two.
Now, the things have gone on. This case was eventually dismissed for want of absolute diversity.
Right.
Another case was filed.
Right.
Has the judge in the new case, I gather it's the same judge.
It's the same judge, same magistrate.
Has he said, has either the judge or the magistrate judge in the new hearing said definitively, I'm going to stand by that sanctions order with respect?
No, Your Honor.
Isn't this kind of an advisory opinion at this point, then?
I don't think so, Your Honor. They have the documents, and they are using them. We see them every time that Emerald files a substantive motion. We see documents from our in-house counsel giving back our own lawyer's evaluation of the lawsuit to us, being argued as a reason why we shouldn't prevail on our legal theories in the case.
We don't yet really know in black and white what's going to happen to those documents, or how they'll be used, what kind of it. We don't know very much, not really before us, that second lawsuit. Why isn't this kind of an advisory opinion as to how the second how those documents should be used in this lawsuit?
Well, the question is not how they should be used, Your Honor, but frankly whether they should be used and whether Emerald should have them at all.
So
our view is that they have our documents that are clearly privileged as a sanction.
So your view is, in effect, there's a lingering disability from the first judgment.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
That is not dependent upon the particular use of the documents in the second litigation?
Well, Your Honor, I think the fact that your opponent in litigation has your privileged documents in their possession and can even attempt to use them, no matter whether they use them or how they use them, has an adverse impact on us, and it's one that can be easily corrected, just as we get inadvertently produced privileged documents back.
What kind of relief could you get in this appeal from case number one that would not amount to an advisory opinion to the judge as to how to proceed in case number two?
They could be ordered to give us our documents back and all copies of our documents, and no longer permitted to use them.
It's the second one that concerns me, because that's a easier said than done kind of situation. Need we reach that question in this case, or is that properly for the trial judge in the case now pending?
Well, Your Honor, if you undo the sanctions order, the only way they have the privileged documents is through the sanctions order. And if they're ordered to give them back, then it seems to me in the new lawsuit, the judge will have to make a determination as to whether or not the documents were privileged. You know, you do have to go back over that ground. and perhaps do what should have been done the first time.
It's a bell that's hard to unring. We could certainly order, in this case, that the documents and all copies be returned.
Yes.
We can't erase from the intellects of the attorneys their knowledge of these documents.
That's right, Your Honor.
But are we in a position in this appeal to really be able to give any definitive guidance as to how the trial judge in the second case should really deal with that problem?
Well, Your Honor, I think if a sanctions order is reversed and they should not have had the documents in the first place, that's all you need to do, and then the judge in the second case can decide what's the effect of the sanctions order being reversed.
And if you're not happy with that, you'll see us 2007.
Right, Your Honor. I think that you cannot give us total relief, that's true. But you can give us partial relief, and that's at least enough for this court to have the jurisdiction to decide whether or not the sanctions order here was an abuse of discretion, which we believe that it clearly was.
On this jurisdictional issue, what happened? Did you folks just miss this problem with the was a limited partner or something?
It was the trustee of a limited partner. In fact, I think Emerald just missed it. We were never able to get discovery into the identity of their limited partners, so we didn't know that they had a problem with diversity.
I see.
If Your Honor has no more questions right now, I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you, Counsel.
You.
We'll hear from Mr. Daugherty next.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Daugherty.
This case involves a decision by the district court to strike Equitable's privilege log and order the documents listed on it produced as a Rule 37 sanction. The district court's decision to strike the log came after 9 months of process and repeated a time and effort by the district court to try to have Equitable submit a proper log. Despite 5 opportunities to do so and clear guidance by the district court at the start of this process as to what the district court thought the log should contain, Equitable never did that.
What kind? Could you be a bit more precise about what kind of guidance he gave, sir?
The first day we were there on a motion to strike the log, and the first log was entirely deficient, and Equitable conceded that. It had approximately 750 entries on it. We challenged the log. Equitable came in and said, we know we have a lot of problems with our log, and we're going to clean it up, Judge. And Judge Ashman gave Equitable, cited to Equitable, 3 cases, one of which he just recently decided a few days before, and I think actually that those parties were in the room before we stepped up. And those cases explained to Equitable the judge's views on privilege. At the end of this 9-month process, the district court imposed the sanction that it did. Our position at that time was that Equitable's behavior during this entire period, the December 2001 to the July 2002 and August 2002 time period, actually warranted dismissal. The district court imposed the lesser sanction of striking the log, which is a sanction contemplated under the rules.
Now, there are other sanctions, even lesser sanctions, he could have applied. Did he discuss any of those with counsel, or does the record contain any discussion by the judge of lesser sanctions?
Your Honor, during this time period, and the answer is no in connection with the privilege log issue, although it told Equitable on the very first day we were there back in December that if it did not properly assert the privilege and did not cleanse its log of non-privileged material, he was going to strike the log. He told him that clearly, I think, on December 11th or December 6th. During this same period, though, and the district court was living with this case, and I'm not exaggerating, I suspect we were there twice a week, every week. I mean, that's a little bit of an exaggeration, but we were there a lot. It had sanctioned Equitable 3 different times during this same period. Once in January 2002 for obstructing the deposition of a high-level Equitable employee. The district court found that counsel was lying during the deposition. He ordered Equitable to fly that executive back here to the Dirksen Center and depose that person here so the judge could supervise the deposition if we had disputes. All that was done at Equitable's expense. He found in May, I think, or April, that Equitable had withheld documents that were clearly requested by discovery requests that were served 16 months earlier, and he ordered two depositions reopened at Equitable's expense. And then in May of 2002, and a lot of this is taking place at the same hearings where we're talking about the privilege lock, he found that Equitable violated an agreed protective order by using material that was designated under that order for business purpose and not for litigation purpose. And he ordered a sanction of fees in excess of $140,000.
Did the judge indicate when he imposed the sanction that we have before us today that he was taking into consideration on the issue of bad faith these matters that you have now mentioned?
He didn't say that directly, Your Honor, but those issues were raised in our briefing on this. We submitted a motion in July 25th, 2002. We raised these sanctions with the district court, and we said that this was a pattern of behavior that had taken place from December 2001 all the way through to where we were now. This pattern of obstruction of discovery in this case.
Why I ask is one of the issues we have to tackle here is the issue of bad faith. And if we look just at the discovery issue we have before us, frankly, the evidence of bad faith is not terribly high. If the judge had relied on these other issues as well, you'd be in better shape. But there isn't, in his, as far as I can tell, in his ruling on this issue, any hearkening back to those other issues as evidence of bad faith here.
The issue was raised in our brief, and in that brief we asked for a dismissal. He did not say it at the hearing, that's clear. He did talk about the known professional competence of these attorneys, and fairly read, that's a statement by Judge Ashman saying, this is deliberate, this is not accidental. These people are too good to get this wrong by mistake. I think that's the only fair way to read that statement, Your Honor. That's a credibility determination as to the lawyers before Judge Ashman at the time. Credibility determinations in this circuit are entitled to great deference and can almost never be clear error based on the case law I read in preparation for this appeal.
Say in this circuit, that's general law of the United States, isn't it?
I think so, yes, Your Honor. I mean, I focus.
Lawyers say to us, in this circuit, we always begin to wonder if we're doing something that's idiosyncratic, but I think that's a general rule.
Correct, Your Honor. I focused on this circuit just because
we're here. Yeah.
We're here. So it was a process. Judge Ashman gave them every opportunity to do this correctly, and ultimately the sanction was the result of Equitable's own acts, nothing that Judge Ashman did. Its own failure to get this right, despite direction, despite guidance, despite numerous opportunities. And I would submit both the sanction, the decision to sanction, and the choice of sanction was eminently reasonable and certainly sustainable under the abuse of discretion standard. On the jurisdictional point.
Now, this is bothersome in the sense that you folks basically conducted discovery in a proceeding of which the court had no jurisdiction. And are now in a second proceeding, apparently going to use what you got in this proceeding that at least theoretically should never have happened.
Well, two issues there. First, the Supreme Court is clear that even in a case where there's no jurisdiction, a district court has the right to sanction a party for misbehavior. And that's what happened here. When you were talking about the advisory opinion, I think in a sense you're absolutely right, because at this time, we don't know how these documents are going to affect the outcome of what we called the refiled action in our briefs or the second action. They may not have any effect on the refiled action. I mean, Equitable's taking the position that there's Rule 403 and 402 problems with some of the documents and they're overly prejudicial. We should not be allowed to use them.
But isn't there great force in your colleague's statement that the mere fact that you can try this second action, having possession of those documents and having the lawyers on your team evaluate those, that in itself puts them at substantial prejudice if you're not supposed to have those documents?
Your Honor, this court has never reviewed discovery orders, even those involving privilege, until the end of the case, because you don't know how they're going to affect the case. And that's the whole point. We cited the Sandwiches case frequently in our briefs. You want to decide all closely related issues, and here the refiled action is a complete copycat copycat of the first action, one time on appeal. And that way you don't have to guess about the effect of your rulings. And here, in a sense, you would be guessing as to what effect your ruling would have on the merits with respect to both the refiled action and the second action.
Why couldn't we do what I talked with opposing counsel about? Why couldn't we decide whether you should have had them in the first action or not? And if we decide you should not have, require that you return them in all copies, and then simply leave it to the district judge in the second action to determine whether any additional remedy is necessary with respect to your use of them in the second action.
First, that opinion may affect the merits in the refiled action, and that's not appropriate under the final judgment rule. You also said it's very hard to unring the bell. We have these documents. We have the knowledge. The only way to handle this at this point is to let the merits play out in the refiled action, let Judge Ashman, let Judge Koukouras, both of whom are seasoned judges, make decisions about prejudice and whether we should be allowed to use these documents, and then evaluate it on the merits. That's what you said in the Powers case. I mean, there's been other situations in this circuit where you had interlocutory, what is in effect, an interlocutory appeal from discovery orders, even those involving privilege, and you've repeatedly said we're going to wait till resolution of the merits, and only after the full merits are decided are we going to address this issue. And that's, in effect, what you did when they were here before 2 years ago on interlocutory review. I mean, the substance of the first action is now in the refiled action. No one disputes that. The complaint is word for word. The district court has said it's going to follow its prior rulings in the first action. So we're doing now the first action in the refiled action. And with all due respect, we should let that play out consistent with your case law and let that go to merits and then evaluate what, if anything, should be done with this sanction. So I would ask, unless you have any questions, I'm willing to waive the rest of my time.
Well, as far as the first action, it was technically over. That was a final, maybe for reasons of jurisdiction, but it was still final, was it not? And the refiling was a completely new case, I assume, with a new filing fee and everything.
You know, I struggled with this, preparing for argument. If you view the 00C6786 action, whatever it was, if you view that label as the first action, then the first action may technically be over.
I'm just using your terms.
But the substance of that first action is now in the refiled action. And in sandwiches, you talked about looking at the realities of the situation. And if you look at the reality of what's going on here, the first action is continuing in the refiled action. Only the label has stopped in that sense. And that's a dismissal without prejudice, Your Honor.
Well, that's the label is still what we have. And as Judge Ripple's pointing out, our options might be limited because we could go through... I assume in the objections on the magistrate judge's recommendation, you objected to all these things. I'm sorry, not you, they.
Right.
To all the different issues that were determining whether or not even those four documents were privileged or not. I assume they went through all of that and objections. I don't know. And then the judge, I guess, overruled them and affirmed the or agreed with the magistrate judge. And then that was it, and then the case is dismissed. So technically, either way, technically it's over, and in the way you say technically it's the same lawsuit and just a continuation.
Correct.
So I don't know which technicality we'll end up following here.
Well, if you look at sandwiches, I think you'll look at the substance and not adopt kind of bright-line tests that don't look at the substance like the Ninth Circuit does, for example, in some of the cases they cited in the Ninth Circuit. Dismissals without prejudice are always viewed as final judgments. Under sandwiches, you say you're going to look at the purposes of the final judgment rule. And one of those purposes is to make sure that all matters relating to a dispute between two parties are resolved in one proceeding. And to do that, you'd have to wait till the resolution of the refiled action and the second action.
Mr. Tardy, could you help us a little bit with exactly how did the magistrate judge determine that certain documents were not privileged? What was the process he went through when these documents were brought before him mean, did he listen to argument of counsel with respect to each of the documents, or how was it done?
We submitted, or Equitable submitted, I guess more accurately, selected documents for his review. In one case, he wrote a written opinion, and I think that was the first time, detailing his position and why documents were or were not privileged. The second time, I think he did it orally, and the last time he did it orally. And I do want to point out that with respect to the determinations that were made the first two times, there was never an appeal with respect to those first two determinations. Never an appeal to the district court. Only with respect to the third one did they take an appeal.
Would it have been reasonable for the magistrate judge to actually examine all the, make an in-camera examination of the last log list?
You know, in the July 25th motion that we did, the final one that led to the sanction, we actually offered a special master. And they objected to that and said, no, well, that's baseless. We don't want a special master.
Well, I guess my question is, I mean, is the number of documents so voluminous that it would be impossible for the magistrate to have looked at them?
Impossible? I don't know. There was a lot of documents, Your Honor. The sampling
reasonable.
Yeah. The sampling procedure he picked, I certainly thought was reasonable in light of the competence of who we were dealing with, Your Honor. And that ultimately, I think, led to the judge's conclusion of bad faith. You know, there's never been any explanation other than kind of vague, we didn't quite do it right, as to why the initial logs...
The list kept getting smaller and smaller over time.
Yeah, I mean, why 300 documents come off only after we challenge this has never really been explained other than we know we didn't do this right. And I don't think that's acceptable, Your Honor. So, thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You have 3.5 minutes, Ms. Odese.
To answer Judge Canny's question, it's about half a box of documents, the whole 400 documents. Half a box. So it would not have been a big burden for someone to have reviewed all of them. And it's in retrospect, it's a shame that all this effort was spent on a relatively small number of documents. The special master, the idea of a special master, Emerald floated that idea as a sanction, and that's why we objected to it, because at that point we thought there was no need for anything else to be done. And on the question of bad faith, the court did not sanction us because 300 documents came off in the very beginning when the privilege log was admittedly not done correctly. He didn't sanction us because of the number of privilege logs. He sanctioned us because he disagreed with the privilege draws that Equitable's lawyers made with respect to really two documents at the end of the day. If it had been two documents that he had a different judgment on, he would have said no sanctions. And all of these other issues that counsel brings out, they did raise that with the magistrate. They did make the argument that Equitable was deliberately hiding important documents on the privilege log. The magistrate did not bite on that. He did not make that ruling. In fact, he said, I find no direct evidence of bad faith. He inferred bad faith solely from his disagreement on this small number of documents based on his small sampling. And on the final point, the final judgment point here, the appellate jurisdiction point, I believe Judge Mannion, what you were asking was, isn't how can we review this from the second case? That's our problem. If we wait to have you review this, the sanctions order was in the first case. There was a final judgment in the first case. We had to appeal it now or lose it forever. The court may be able to deal in the second case with whether the documents should have been used or not, but I don't see how it has the power to deal with the question of whether or not the sanctions order was appropriate.
Are you saying that if this isn't reversed and these documents are at least physically returned, obviously you can't mentally return them, physically returned, that only then would you have an opportunity to ask the judge to explore each document on an individual
yes.
basis? Otherwise, you think that there's no challenge left?
The sanction order, Your Honor, is part of a final order, as counsel said, under Supreme Court precedent. It survives, even though there was no jurisdiction. So we had to appeal it now, and the court has to decide it now. Otherwise, I don't think you can decide in the second case. In fact, Judge Posner's opinion in Hill versus Potter, which is a very similar type of case where a case was dismissed for lack of subject matter jurisdiction. It was then refiled in federal court, and Judge Posner said, you should have appealed in that first case because it was a final judgment, and it's res judicata on certain issues that were not wiped out by the lack of subject matter jurisdiction. So I think there's a real problem with going ahead in this case without deciding this issue now.
I'm just speculating here, but is there some possibility that we could determine that that wasn't res judicata and these were up for grabs in the next case? I say up for grabs, meaning they can be challenged and that there's no res judicata. I don't know. I'm just saying if they thought of that.
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think that the rules have been pretty clear and that you want to keep the clear rules that when you have a final judgment, that's the time to appeal. And if you start fiddling with them around the edges in a particular case, then it's just going to create confusion for everyone, the court and for the litigants alike. Thank you. We'd ask you to reverse the judgment.
Thank you, Ms. Ardizzi.